Hello, Pesca Plus subscribers get a fantastic discount and great content. But really, it's more than just content. It's also community, or at least some pretty fun opportunities like winning a trivia contest.
My head is full of just useless knowledge.
We also had a Pesca Plus Fantasy Football Listener League. That's the PPFFLL. It's going on right now. I'm in maybe a strong fourth place. I'll tell you how it goes. I think winning the whole thing might be a little gauche, but I'd like to make the championship as the season progresses. We have bonus interviews at least once a week.
A friend of mine is a professional singer, and she got called for a session, and she shows up, and it's Paul McCartney. So they do the session, and she sings. And then at the end, she says, may I take a selfie? And he says, why don't we just sit down and get to know each other and talk for 20 minutes?
And then we have these weird interviews about time itself.
So, you know, clocks.
Noam, yes. Keep time. Those ones.
Two cycles, 12 hours each. But I propose that instead of doing that, we do three cycles of 8 hours each.
Big get there. Not going to tell you who it was. A burgeoning genius on the time recalibration scene. To subscribe, go to subscribe.mikepesca.com. And for 20% off, use the promo code CHEESE. Please don't specify. No Jarlsberg, no cheddar necessary. CHEESE. Thanks. Enjoy the show. It's Wednesday, December 11th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Finally, Israel has done something the world will applaud. It took aim, literally, at Bashar al-Assad's stockpile of chemical weapons and destroyed it. Banned by international agreement, a prima facie crime against humanity, these were once dangerous weapons in the hands of a tyrant who did use them, and now they're not. Thank you, Israel, said the world. Only the world did not say that. Geir Pedersen, the United Nations Special Envoy for Syria, I guess you got to change your business cards these days, called on Israel to halt its, quote, very troubling military operations and said de-escalation was needed. We're continuing to see Israel movements and bombardments into Syrian territory. This needs to stop. The BBC reported on the UN's displeasure and also tracked down an expert to answer the burning question, again, literally, of if setting weapons on fire is a good way to destroy weapons.
One expert we spoke to said, setting fire to chemical weapons is a good way to destroy them if you want to do so quickly. But he said there is, of course, a chance of collateral damage and casualties on the ground, but probably a smaller chance of contamination.
Experts agree. Chemical weapons bad. But Israel also bad. Now, Israel did incur into Syrian land, and that was part of what was being decried by the UN. And on that, I understand. And I also think Israel will ignore the UN on that score. But destroying a weapons cache, and in fact, destroying Syria's almost their entire navy, 80% of their navy, a country that could fall into the hands of who knows or just chaos, it is a good thing for peace and everyone in the world, except maybe Russia, which does have a veto on the Security Council and did aid the Syrians in past sarin attacks. So maybe the UN is not the most clear-eyed body to adjudicate this one. Now, I'm just going by what I know. I did not ask an expert, but if I had, I bet he would say, yeah, burning up the chemical weapons and almost the entire Navy, it does rid you of the weapons. Giving the Russians a say in this matter probably does not. On the show today, I spiel about an international development many leagues away and settled with dollars, but not U.S. dollars, Australian dollars and the Nauruans. It shan't be their ruin. Just a note for the spiel, I might have called them Nauruvians. The demonym is Nauruan. But should they wish to be known as Nauruvians, both can apply. But first, Shadi Amid is a guy I've been wanting to have on the show for a while. He's a columnist at the Washington Post. He really has a strong understanding of international affairs and on Israel and their tactics in pursuing their war aims. We disagree. Hamid would identify and has identified as a strong critic of Israel, but he's also a very good person to get into a discussion or a debate with, as I hope you will hear Shadi Amid up next. Shadi Hamid is a professor, a columnist for The Washington Post, one of the co-hosts of the Wisdom of Crowds podcast, which not only is extremely interesting, but really models proper disagreement. He's an outspoken critic of Israel's war in Gaza and the U.S., specifically Joe Biden's complicity. So we're going to have one of those very well-modeled, high-minded, perhaps agreements, somewhat disagreements. I just want to tease out and hear what he has to say and what he's thinking. Shadi, welcome to The Gist.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Let's start here. Let's start with the recent war in Lebanon. Ceasefire was signed. What do you think Israel had, and if you even object to the phrase, tell me, but what did Israel have the right to do in pursuing this war?
Yeah, so obviously Israel doesn't like Hezbollah, the militant group that's based in the south of Lebanon, and there have been a number of wars and violent conflicts with Hezbollah over the past several decades. So it's certainly Israel has a right to not have rockets lobbed at it by Hezbollah or other militant groups. But that doesn't justify going into southern Lebanon and into Beirut, the capital, and bombing apartment blocks and displacing over one-fifth of the entire country's population. What we're seeing here is such a disproportionate approach to warfare, one that has really no regard for civilian casualties and suffering. And at some level, I get it. Israel doesn't really care about Arab lives, and it prioritizes its own citizens above all else. And it's willing to inflict a lot of damage on civilian infrastructure, not just in Lebanon, obviously, but also in Gaza, as we've seen over the past year. But for those of us who aren't in Israel or aren't Israeli and who are trying to look at this objectively, I just think it's very hard for any of us on the outside to look at this and say, well, Israel is justified in inflicting this level of damage to a country without much regard to distinguishing between combatants and non-combatants. And certainly that's not the way that we as Americans conduct war. You can say whatever you want, and that's quite a lot about the disasters we've been involved with in previous wars, such as in Iraq and Afghanistan. But we didn't do what Israel is doing now. And the U.S. is much more careful when it comes to civilian casualties.
So this is why I wanted to start with Hezbollah and Lebanon. The Lebanese Ministry of Health, which I think is more credibility than the Hamas Ministry of Health, puts out statistics, and there's upwards almost 4,000 killed, and they count women and children. In fact, they have graphics that they don't use the word killed. They say martyred or wounded, but the martyred have been almost 4,000 killed, and they count 600 women and 250 children. Let's also note there's been that massive displacement. I can't make a judgment based on those numbers. One can't say proportionality. The laws of proportionality are really capacious, so that many, many things get considered proportionate. But I'm just analogizing it to, say, a U.S. context. And if a nearby neighbor were launching attacks, and then as a result, thousands were killed, but, you know, three quarters of them were, we don't know if they were Hezbollah, but they were military aged men. I would think that most Americans would think that that was, if not justified, a necessity. So just looking at the numbers and looking at the destruction and grieving for everyone who didn't deserve to die, I don't know if I would use the word justified, but there's an explicability to it that, before we even get to Gaza, I do think applies in Lebanon, but you don't?
I sure hope Americans wouldn't think that. If there was a Mexican militant group along the border that was launching rockets, and we went back and obliterated Mexico City and caused a refugee run and internal displacement of one-fifth of the Mexican population, I mean, God help me, I sure hope that we as Americans would be able to look at that and say that our government was overstepping its bounds, however angry and justifiably so we are at, we would be towards Mexico. Also, the three quarters being combatants in Lebanon, I don't think that's quite the case. I haven't seen much evidence that the level of civilian casualties is that low. But of course, like, we won't know for sure until the conflict is over. But that that number of women and children killed is a significant percentage of the overall death toll. And again, if there were that many Mexican women or children killed as part of the overall total, I think we as Americans would be right to say, well, was that necessary? Was that justified? I mean, pretty much the way Israel conducts war is that if there's a mid-level Hezbollah commander in an apartment block, they'll just say, well, that justifies us leveling the apartment block. That's also been the policy in Gaza. Sure, you could always find a mid-level militant commander pretty much anywhere in these densely populated cities, but does that mean that you should just go ahead and act and blow the place up without a more careful consideration? Again, what it really comes down to is how much regard you have for innocent lives. And I would like to think that whether it's Mexico or Canada, that we would be very, very attentive to any number of civilians who are around a mid-level commander and say, well, actually, we really want to get this bad guy, but there's two women around him, or there's a family in the other apartment building next to him. Do we really want to go ahead and do that? And again, maybe I just hold Americans to a higher standard, but that's sort of how I would see it if we're making that analogy.
Yeah. So we disagree. I have no doubt that, first of all, you have to, if you're extending the analogy, I don't know, let's make it Canada. The Canadian government was essentially controlled by some foreign power. It seems far-fetched. But this is the analogy with Hezbollah. It's not as if it's just a rogue cartel operating independently from the state apparatus as a whole. And I do think that if rockets were being rained down on Detroit or Montana, let's say, and tens of thousands of people had to leave and there was this huge cache of the Canadian militant group rockets, and it was causing casualties on the American side, that Americans would go in pretty strong.
Sure, they might, but would that be okay? I agree with you that realistically, Americans would react in this punitive way and they would want revenge. I mean, we were like that after 9/11. I'm just saying, I don't think that's good.
Right.
I don't think we should be that way. I think the impulse to revenge is understandable, but it's one that should be resisted. If we feel that the revenge is coming out inside of us, then I think it's important for us to be like, well, is that good?
Right. And I think the important thing there is if it's untethered to actual strategic success, and this is the lesson of post-Iraq 9/11, did we really achieve our objectives? And it is early to tell with Hezbollah and Lebanon, but it does seem to me, actually, I hate that construction. I was surprised by how successful the Israeli military campaign was, and extending all the intelligence campaigns and the Beeper campaign. Much of the calculation beforehand, and I listened to your show talking about this, what if this is another slog, another example of Israel being bogged down in 82? And I said, you have to credit that because that has been the history. But it does seem, again, there I go, but it looks to me as if Israel achieved a lot more than I thought they could by military means. And just taking Hezbollah's rocket arsenal from 150,000 to 30,000, if you believe the IDF estimates, is impressive. I don't know if it's worth it. I don't know if that's the worth of human, if it's worth it in human life. But that's part of the calculation. Can any actor, America or Israel, get what it wants militarily? Before the war, we were told it's pretty much impossible. But after the war has happened, it was more possible than I thought it would be. What about you?
Yeah, so you degrade Hezbollah's military capabilities. Great. No, that is great from an Israeli perspective, and I don't discount that. But then you have to think about the medium to long term. With a high civilian toll, you create a segment of the population that wants revenge from their standpoint. And the sons and daughters and family members of those who have been killed or those who have been displaced, basically, you have a new generation that's going to hate Israel more than the previous generation. And Israel has to live with its neighbors. So at some point you have to say, well, if we look at this from a longer term perspective, is this level of destruction ultimately going to work out in Israel's favor? I would say that this argument is even is much stronger when it comes to Gaza, because there the death toll is much worse. And basically they're not even like keeping track as much anymore, but 44,000 plus, you know, different estimates that as many as 2/3 are civilians. The majority are women and children. In the case of Gaza, I think we're talking about that revenge dynamic and that cycle of violence going from generation to a generation. You know, so you have to ask yourself, and I think we asked ourselves this after Iraq or after Afghanistan, where the Taliban seemed degraded, not just degraded, but utterly defeated in the months after September 11th. 20 years later, fast forward, Taliban makes a comeback and had been making comeback for many years. So I think that's the kind of time horizon that we have to be looking at this at, not just 6 months or a year, but what happens 10 to 15 to 20 years from now. And that's where I'm much less optimistic.
But isn't that argument that if you strike down either someone engaged in counterinsurgency within your borders or a hostile actor right over your borders, you're going to create, whatever the multiple is, two more people who are angry at you? Isn't that an argument for every insurgency in the history of the world winning? There seems to be no way to cut the head off the Hydra. If that were true, wouldn't the Tamil Tigers and the FARC in Colombia and the residents of Grozny who were effectively crushed by the Russia, wouldn't they be ascendant and successful now?
Yeah, well, that is the Grozny model. That is the Sri Lankan model. So the Sri Lankan military was able to destroy the Tamil Tigers, but they did so with such brutality that I think most observers look at the Sri Lankan model and say, well, that was basically genocidal. That was about wiping out entire cities. I mean, you can do that, and maybe that can work in quotation marks, but the U.S. and Western allies are not expected to conduct war in that way, and I think that's a good thing, that you're not supposed to just level cities, even if you think it might work. And now, there, for every Sri Lankan case you have other cases where a government tried to level a city, but then you had a radicalization process that resulted. I mean, you can try to just break the spirit of your enemies to such an extent that they can never recover. But that's a very difficult calculation to make. It's and you don't know for sure if that's going to happen until it's too late and until you kill a lot of people. The way the Russian military conducted itself in Grozny was something that the rest of the world looked at and said, hopefully never again. And that's why I think the phrase never again is an important one. So, you know, I think that the way that the U.S. tried to do counterinsurgency in Iraq, and at some points it did actually work, I mean, during the surge and at subsequent periods in the fight against ISIS, is that you try to separate the insurgents from the broader population. And you try to convince the broader population that the insurgents don't have their interests in mind. And that's, I think that's generally speaking, the preferable, you know, model. I think that in the case of Israel, again, Israel can't completely isolate itself from the rest of the Middle East. So ultimately, they have to come to some kind of truce with their enemies. Or you have to find some way to integrate some of your enemies, the ones who are willing to demobilize and de-arm or come to some kind of understanding, and you try to bring them into a political process. Because the problem with groups like Hezbollah and Hamas is that they're not isolated from the rest of the population. They're integrated with the rest of the population. So it's very hard to just say, well, we're going to kill them all. I mean, what about mid-level Hamas fighters? Can you kill tens of thousands of fighters? Can you kill every single one? Or do you try to focus on the top level commanders and then try to say, well, the people who are left over, if they're willing to come to some kind of agreement And that can differ depending on what the conflict is. Let's say they're willing to give up some of their arms and go through that demobilization process. Then perhaps there's a path towards a longer term truce, assuming that you can't kill everyone.
Right. So I think Israel said both and. I mean, they certainly have wiped out leadership of Hamas. And also they say your number, tens of thousands, you know, 20,000 or so fighters. Of course, 20,000 or so civilians got killed in that exchange.
Yes. So first of all, Israel's claims when it comes to how many fighters it's killed, I would take that with a grain of salt. Again, I think there's this tendency
for us. We can share the grain that I have with Hamas's death numbers from their Ministry of Health. Yeah.
Yeah. So look, not to get into that, you know, I know that's obviously something that we're probably going to have to just agree to disagree on. But I think there is a tendency to look at Israel as if it's a Western liberal state, that they're like us, they look like us, that there's a sense that I just worry about the kind of construction that Israel is a sea of. Israel is sort of like an island of civilization in a sea of barbarism. Not that you're saying that, but I think when I look at the media coverage of this and how a lot of Westerners look at this, I think we have this idea of Israel that is outdated, that they are like us, they conduct war like us, that they are Westernized like us, that they follow the laws of war, so on and so forth. I just think that the events of the past year should put a lot of that under doubt. And I think that when we look at Joe Biden's approach and why he's been so sympathetic to Israel, and I've written a lot about this, I think he has a view of Israel as the underdog that comes basically from the 1960s and 70s. And Israel was more of an underdog then. And I just think that we have to be careful about not extrapolating from this idea of, look, a scrappy ragtag group of Israelis who are fighting for their independence. Israel now is the dominant actor in the Middle East. It has by far the most powerful military. It is by far the largest recipient of military aid on a per capita basis in the Middle East. It is the largest recipient of military assistance in the world. And I think we have to look at those facts and think, well, you know, Israel is pretty damn aggressive in the region. And to the extent that we as Americans are complicit in that, that's where I think we have to take a step back and say, look, we get it that Israelis want revenge after what happened on October 7th. Totally understandable. But we're Americans. We're not Israelis. And we can try to look at it with the benefit of arm's length and having some distance from it and saying, do we want to be implicated in what Israel is doing?
And we will be back tomorrow to talk more with Shadi Hamid, the Washington Post columnist, the author most recently of Rethinking Political Islam. Tomorrow, the idea of collective punishment as it comes to the Palestinians. Shadi Hamid, tomorrow. And now the spiel to Nauruvian politics. The gist, your stateside place for all Nauru news. That's good news. And it was good news yesterday, to quote Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese.
This is a good day for Australia. This is a good day for Nauru.
I'd say it's a good day for Nauru, as Australian broadcaster SBS detailed.
Australia will provide the nation of 12,000 $140 million over 5 years in direct budget support, policing and security.
You know, a lot of people ask me, Mike, what is the key to your perspicacious news analysis? And I pay them the 10 bucks I promised them for asking the question. And then I answer, division. And they say, oh, division. So it's your keen awareness of the roiling tensions afflicting society. And I say, okay, here's another $5. And I say, no, it's that I could do division. Math. $140 million divided by 12,000 is almost $12,000 a person. And I know you Australian watchers are saying, Mike, that's Australian dollars. Okay, but in U.S. money, it is like 7,500 a Nauruvian. And if you are the median Nehruvian, which is to say Nehruvian number 6,000 or so, you make $12,000 a year. So Australia hasn't doubled the GDP or doubled the per capita income, but it has increased it by over 60%. Division. Division was involved in that calculation too, my friends. And why or how did Nauru earn this? I will tell you what they did, and it was hard and it was tough. It was to not take China's money. The best business currently going in the Pacific Ocean is not to do business with China. They gave Australia a first look deal at PACs, trade PACs, military PACs, and Australia says, yeah, we'd like a veto power. Here's $140 million. And they said, Australian? They said, of course, we're Australian. And Nauru still took it. It is quite a growth industry all throughout the Pacific Island economies not to do business with China. A speck of land without much prospects now that the phosphorus is gone, Nauru was historically taken advantage of for most of its existence. But now it is in a position to play the sides off against each other. You do you, Nauru. Not doing business with China is a real growth industry. Don't tell the NBA, I guess. And next up on the Australian gravy train, or Vegemite dirigible, as it were, Tuvalu. Now, Tuvalu cut its deal already, and Tuvalu only got $113 Australian dollars, and it's about the same size population as Nauru, maybe a couple hundred people fewer. Nauru drives a harder bargain than Tuvalu. It's sort of like Scott Boras playing the Mets off the Yankees over there in the Pacific, except the entire economy of Tuvalu is $60 million U.S., and Juan Soto's salary is $50 million U.S. You know, this maybe seems unfair. If you're saying, wow, one guy swings a bat and gets $50 million. Well, all Tuvalu did to get even more, tens of millions more than that, is not do business with China. Plus, if you're an all-American or all-Tuvaluvian, great. The equivalent in this country would be that there's 27,000 other people like you. Look, I'm not saying the U.S. is better or the best, but it's bigger. And compared to Australia, let's just point this out. Australia has the Union Jack on their flag. They're part of the Commonwealth. They sound like that guy sounded, and that guy's name is pronounced Anthony Albanese instead of Anthony Albanese, like seven guys I went to high school with. And yet, with all the Englishness, they still use dollars. So I would say we're doing something right, as are now Tuvalu and Nauru. Next up, Kiribati. And the gist will be there, uniting Oceania through division. That's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Leo Baum's the intern. Michelle Pesca's the CBSO of Peachfish Productions. Umperu, Jeeperu, Duperu, Tuvalu, and Nauru. Thanks for listening.